This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Today we'll hear from the veteran political consultant Roy Fletcher. He'll give his take on what's going on in Baton Rouge and in the nation's capital. And we'll also hear, if things go according to form, from U.S. Senator John Neely Kennedy, who is up in arms about the Harris bill that is being considered at the state capitol. He says it's a bad bill for the state. And, of course, Senator Kennedy has become one of the most outspoken members of the United States Senate. We'll talk with him about some other matters, including the prospect of him running for governor. And we'll hear from Andrew Yang. He is running for president of the United States. He's a CEO, and his book is The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We are slated to hear later in the hour from Senator John Kennedy if things go according to plan. He's a busy man and will be dialing in from Washington. And if you would like to dial us, we start with Roy Fletcher, the well-known political consultant of many years. The number is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633, and talk at talklouisiana.org if you prefer email. Roy Fletcher is a man who was mentored by one Gus Weil, who died a few weeks ago on Friday the 13th of April, and we haven't talked to you on the air about the departure of the grand man of politics, who lived to be 85 years old, Roy, but Gus certainly had a full life.
Gus simply was a character, and he had a full life. And what he didn't have, he made up.
Now.
I know, but he's a wonderful guy. I mean, and I enjoyed working for him, and he helped me along in my career, and he did mentor me, and he was a he was very, 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 very instrumental in my life. Yeah, and at a time when I needed some. Mm-hmm. You know, some direction. And I knew what I wanted to do, and I was doing it, but he kind of helped me with some things that needed to be helped with. But he didn't leave me very perfect, I can say that.
Well, by nature, political consultants are imperfect beings, as are all of us.
Yes.
Especially journalists.
We seem to exaggerate it a little more than
but
most.
At one time, in one political shop in Baton Rouge, I think all of them, it was you, Gus, Raymond Strother, and James Carville.
That's correct.
All at the same time.
All at the same time. And, I mean, and you couldn't breathe. There just wasn't any oxygen in the room. You know, and I was sort of the quiet one, if you can imagine. And, man, between Carville and Gus and Raymond, it just wasn't a whole lot of room in there. It's a lot of elbowing underneath the basket. But I kind of learned my way around that and became close to all three of them in different ways. And it was nice. Mm-hmm.
And remained close.
I suppose so, yeah.
We became competitive in some cases,
yes,
too.
Yes, very much so.
And your politics evolved. They basically stayed...
They stayed where they were.
Left of center, but you moved.
Yeah, I went... You know, I think it was once I got out of there and had to scrap for myself, I began to see things a little differently, and it just, you know, I changed. But... Yeah, I'm still changing, I hope. I don't want to be I don't want to stop.
What life is all about. If
we're
not changing, we're not living.
But
if I remember right, you changed your party affiliation the day that Mike Foster
I did.
You changed together, didn't you?
Well, he was down there in Franklin and I was up here, and I figured I better get right with the old man. I did.
And he was running for governor.
That's correct.
And he won.
Yeah.
And that race was not an easy one for a, at that time, relatively unknown state senator to win. It had Buddy Romer. It had Mary Landrieu. It had Melinda Schwegman. It had Phil Price.
Cleo Fields.
Cleo Fields, who ended up being in a runoff.
Yeah.
It was a cast of important people.
Yes, it was. You know, Gus was lurking around in the background there a little bit, and he was a big proponent of Foster's. But I got to tell you, Jim, it was very hard when I first signed that campaign, when people would say, "Who in the hell is that?"
Mike Foster.
Yeah. Well, you're just taking his money. Yeah, that's what I do. But I mean, still, I'm gonna win. You know, it's kind of weird. It was different.
But so much of politics is timing.
It is.
And he changed parties at the right time. And he edged out Buddy Romer. And in order to do that, you had to run a rather aggressive race against Romer.
Yeah, well, what happened was we'd set it up so well, and then when we did it, it made sense. And we were really moving, and Governor Romer's campaign, run by one Mr. John N. Kennedy, mm-hmm. began to attack us, and
95.
We responded to him, and that's where the line, the record shows it, and Romer knows it.
Several spots.
Yeah, several spots. Right.
But you and Romer have become good friends.
Yes.
And that shows you that sometimes people can put aside the partisan nature.
I have a great deal of respect for Buddy Romer.
And the way he has fought his latest challenge, having had a stroke a few years ago, has shown, I think, much more about him than when he was riding high.
I think so, too. You and I saw him one day a while back at a restaurant. And, I mean, it's remarkable what Buddy has done to recover from all of that and to be still as active as he is. Mm-hmm. You know, he moves a little slower, but he's still there. And
he's still in the game.
Yeah, he's still in the game.
He'll be 75 years old on October 4th. Charles E. Buddy Romer, who's battled diabetes since being diagnosed at the age of 29. Roy Fletcher, you also were close at one time with John McCain, who's written his memoirs.
Yes.
And he is dying, a terminal diagnosis with glioblastoma, brain cancer.
Yes.
What a fascinating fellow he is.
Jim, you're right that it was at one time, but he is a fascinating guy. You know, that 2000 campaign was interesting because McCain has sort of become the establishment guy all of us, you know, the last few years, the Republican establishment guy. But John McCain was not that guy in 2000. He was despised by the Republican establishment, so much so that in South Carolina they said everything in the world about him to try to stop him in that primary.
They being the Bush campaign and Karl Rove.
The Bush campaign, Karl Rove, any group that was associated sort of with establishment Republicans, and it was ferocious, but he was not one of them. They viewed him, and he'd just come off a big victory in New Hampshire, and they shocked him. It shocked the establishment, and it shocked the press, I think. And they just had to stop him because they knew he had momentum, and they did in South Carolina. Little known history is that we came back a week later and won, I think it was a week later, Michigan.
Yeah, he was on his way until South Carolina, and people now who are with George Bush and talk about how he was above reproach. And criticized Donald Trump.
This is politics.
Well, but in 2000, it was George Bush and Karl Rove who accused John McCain of having an illegitimate black child.
I don't know if it was them,
well,
to be honest, but I will say this. It was a group of people in South Carolina that did so, and the story was Senator McCain's wife had been in, I think, Pakistan or one of those countries, and had seen this child with a cleft mouth and bought her home and told John that they were adopting her. And so she was in pictures, and so immediately the thing got started was that he had a black lover and had a out-of-wedlock black child. I mean, the most. And I traced it. We traced it. I know where it came from. I know right where it came from, and I accused all kind of people of it, but I finally found the source of it. And it was from a, perhaps a religious university. I'll leave it at that.
In South Carolina.
In South Carolina.
Initials BJU.
Well, I don't, right. I'm not going to confirm that, but I can tell you that's where it came from.
Well, it was a campaign that ended with George Bush winning the presidency yep. in the most unusual way against Albert Gore.
It was.
But I have a feeling
probably
that
the beginning of all of this real.
Right. The world changed with that election.
Yes, it did.
But if John McCain had been the Republican nominee, how would he have run against Al Gore? Would he have won without the Supreme Court voting 4-3 to give him the election?
We believed so. I mean,
5-4.
Yeah, 5-4. We believed so, and of course you always do. But I think that McCain was not a doctrinaire conservative by any stretch of the imagination, and he was all over the map. And I think that would have made it very difficult to run against McCain. It may have made it difficult for McCain to rally the Republican base. But he would have, I think we would have won that race, yeah.
He now says he wishes he had chosen Joe Lieberman, who was Gore's running mate, as his running mate in 2008.
Yeah. I was always surprised that he didn't. I really was. I was surprised.
Maybe that's what we need, is a bipartisan ticket.
Well, it would have been interesting, at least. But Joe Lieberman, I thought, would have been an interesting pick for
him. Well, he is a very conservative, as we found out.
Yes.
Now former Democrat.
Yes, independent now.
877-217-5757 is your number. Ali Baltazar producing. Our guest for a little while longer is the venerable Roy Fletcher. We're back after this brief pause on 89.3 WRKN. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us. Roy Fletcher is our guest, the well-known political consultant who, through the years, has handled both Republicans and Democrats, and I think occasionally still works for a Democrat. But in Louisiana, there aren't that many Democrats standing in statewide office, and Roy usually works the big races. And when we're talking about the biggest race of all in our state, it's the governor's election. In Louisiana, it trumps everything, and we're about to find out, it appears, that a U.S. senator is willing to give up a cush job in Washington. Some believe that there's nothing better in American politics than being a United States senator, but we saw David Vitter try to become governor, and now we may very well see John Kennedy try to become governor. And Roy, if that happens, and Senator Kennedy, I'm sure, will have to pull the trigger soon if he's going to run, I would think that would be a very competitive race between him and the incumbent John Bel Edwards.
It will be a very, very competitive race, a very close race. I think the edge, probably slight edge, to Kennedy right now, but because of the Republican nature of our state, and John is such a good campaigner, great on his feet and great speaker, that he may very well spread that some, but right now it's 50-50, maybe a slight edge to Kennedy. I think slight edge to Kennedy, only because of the Republican nature of the state.
Well, polls show John Bel Edwards is relatively popular, but that could change depending on what happens in the next month and a half.
I think the governor is personally popular. I think that when he gets matched up against somebody, then you see sort of the division express itself.
Could we have a Kennedy fatigue? He has run for a lot of offices.
No, because Kennedy has an amazing capacity to keep himself fresh. You know, I got to tell you, what he's done in the Senate and how he's captivated national press with his folksy nature has sort of reinvented him to very people that he served and ran in for so long. He's not the same John Kennedy as we saw 8 years ago. That was a much more intense, programmatic, kind of substantive John. Now he makes his points, but he does it in a completely different way. He's changed himself.
877-217-5757 for Roy Fletcher, Dan downtown. Hi, Dan. You're on the air with...
Morning, Dan.
Roy Fletcher.
Morning. Yeah, does your experience with Bob Jones University and seeing the support for Trump indicate that many evangelicals care more about power and money in this life than their eternal salvation?
If I'm going to talk about first of all, I didn't say Bob Jones. Secondly, to say what somebody cares about, I can't do that as a group. I can say that they're pretty damn tough competitors in politics.
Well, I think Dan's noting the hypocrisy of politics, and it cuts both ways.
I think they're tough competitors.
There are people who defended Bill Clinton, went to the mat with him in 1998, who now think Trump should go, independent of the Russia probe, because of the porn star from Baton Rouge. And then there are people who said Clinton was trash, he was a disgrace to America,
and now they're defending
Trump.
You know, consistency is the result of small minds.
The hobgoblin.
No, whatever the hell it is.
877-217-5757. David in Atlanta. Hello, David. You're on the air with Roy Fletcher. Hi, David.
Good morning. The fact that the Louisiana legislature is on the verge of making it necessary to kick thousands of elderly disabled people out of nursing homes. Some of these people may be notified by mail soon. Many of these people may literally worry themselves sick because they have nowhere to go other than live on the street. This is another reason, thanks to the conservative leadership in Louisiana, I'd rather have a sister working at the Canal Street brothel than a member of my family belonging to the Republican Party.
David's blaming the GOP-dominated legislature for this. He's correct that there is a division of opinion about how to address the budget.
I will say this, is that before we get way out there, now I understand, and I was told this yesterday, that a lot of these, like eviction, whatever you call these notices and things to state employees and that sort of thing, are required under some sort of law. I don't know if that's true or not, but before we all get really crazy here, remember, we've pretty well been in this place a lot of times, and they looked down the barrel of the gun, and they figured it out. You know, there is people over there like Alario and people like that that sort of have an institutional memory that they can talk to people. And I think that we're going to work this out. I think it's going to get worked out. Mm-hmm. And if people were smart, they can probably take care of those people that we're talking about and reduce taxes by a half cent and walk away and say they took care of the people and cut taxes. I mean, I'm just saying, if you're a smart messenger, you can do that.
And that's what you do, and that may be very well what happens. They also could get some money from Harris, potentially.
They ought to get a truckload, but
they ought to. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, what the 30 years? Come, I just
well,
I was,
yeah, and it was over $100 million three decades ago that Harris ponied up.
Yeah.
And this time around, they weren't going to pony up anything, but now the legislature, I think, is going to require something.
Somebody caught him.
Well, it's not a matter of catching them.
No.
If you were on Harris' side, would you say, oh, by the way?
No, I don't think I would do that.
These are astute people.
No, they're very smart people. But on the other hand, it was, somebody had to disclose that, and now we're back to even, and let's deal.
All right. A listener asked about the president yesterday getting out of the Iran pact, the nuclear agreement that he long scorned. What do you think of?
Yesterday was a fabulous
president
news day,
Trump.
Wasn't it? I was for getting out. Okay, I mean, let me just say that I never was for getting in, and the way we got in really bothered me a great deal. The optics on it were terrible, but I mean, you know, it was pretty obvious that we were headed out because Trump had said that in the campaign, and he believes that. I think it gives another chance, and I think that the president of France was here for a reason, along with Merkel, and I think they worked out a deal where it's a good cop, bad cop, and I think that Trump is the bad cop. and Merkel and the president of France are going to be the good cops. And when we get through with this, we're going to have a deal that's much more transparent, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that we will end up with another deal.
All right. A shell company that Michael Cohen used to pay hush money to a pornographic film actress, Stormy Daniels, received payments totaling more than $1 million from an American company linked to a Russian oligarch and several corporations with businesses before the Trump administration. Is this legitimate?
Somebody going to have to look at it. It's not anything that you blink on. I mean, you got to look at that. I think that when it's all said and done, it'll be, mumbo-jumbo. But on the other hand, it's legitimate. Look at it. I mean, and Michael Cohen he got some explaining to do. Yeah, he does.
Do you think the president, you being a good lawyer, Roy Fletcher, will pardon people?
I think Michael Flynn will.
You'll pardon Flynn?
I think he'll pardon Flynn, absolutely.
Will he pardon Cohen?
No, I don't think he'll do that. I think that Cohen is sort of an operator on his own, and I think I don't believe that, given the nature, when this story came out, was put out by the Stormy lawyer, I think that probably with some coordination there. But on the other hand, we know that they have a lot of the records and a lot of the, maybe even the phone calls and stuff, and Trump was not mentioned in that, and if they had connections, it would have been leaked.
Roy Fletcher remains bullish on the 45th
totally
American
bullish
president. 877-217-5757. When we return, we may hear from John Kennedy. That's the plan, the U.S. Senator from Louisiana. We might hear a little more from Roy Fletcher, too. Stay tuned. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and we're pleased to have U.S. Senator John Neely Kennedy with us, the pride of Zachary. Took office the beginning of last year as a U.S. Senator after about two decades as our state treasurer. And he is involved, of course, in many issues, as we see and hear on Capitol Hill, but also is closely following what's going on in the Louisiana legislature. And House Bill 553 is the one that pertains to Harris. The company is asking the state legislature to approve a 30-year extension of its state license, which currently expires in 2024. So there is still ample time to renegotiate, but lawmakers are trying to get it done now. And this bill's sponsor is the House Speaker, Taylor Barra, of New Iberia. Senator Kennedy, what's your take on this legislation?
I think it's a mistake, Jim. As you know, Harrah's operates the single land-based casino in New Orleans. To operate, they have to get a lease from the city of New Orleans, but they got to get a license from Louisiana. Harrah's license doesn't expire for 6 years. Harrah's is pushing a bill that would give them a renewal of the license initially for 36 years, 36 years remaining and 30 extra years. I understand there's an option for another 30 years. Even if they don't exercise the option, this ties us up until, I think, something like 2054. The license is, doesn't expire for 6 years, so there's no emergency. For whatever reason, the state hasn't bid out the license. To my knowledge, we don't have any financial analysis. We are depending exclusively on what Harrah's tells us. Harrah's tells us that the taxpayers of the state will gain an extra $125 million over the life of the new lease. What Harrah's is not telling everybody is that, according to some financial analysts that I have talked to, Harrah's will make well over $1 billion. If somebody came to your house tomorrow, Jim, and said, I want to buy it and I'll pay you, $250,000, your house is probably worth a lot more than that, Inkster, but say $250,000.
Actually not, but keep going.
I don't believe that. But somebody knocks on your door and says, I'll pay you $250,000 cash. Now, we can both agree that $250,000 is a heck of a lot of money. But you wouldn't take that offer. You'd go get an appraisal. You'd say, hey, you know, I haven't looked at values in a while. I better go find out what my house is really worth. We haven't done that. And the bill passed the House. I'm not surprised. Harris has like 17 lobbyists they've hired. Now, how many lawyers? It's stuck in the Senate. To their credit, Senator Gary Smith has held it up in committee. Senator John Barrio, I'm hoping I'm leaving that out. Senator Greg Tarver, a bunch of people are asking really hard questions, and I just don't see the rush. I can't imagine that we would do this without a financial analysis and without bidding it out. You know, when Edwin Edwards negotiated the original deal, he got Harris to pay $125 million up front cash and $100 million a year in rent. Now, on the deal, renewing the license, Harris pays zero up front in cash and $67 million rent. We're going backwards.
Well, and that's not factoring in inflation either. So those numbers that you mentioned are 30-year-old numbers. They would be much higher today. So Harris appears to be getting a good deal if this goes through, and it was approved by the House. But the claim is that they're going to make a lot of improvements that will be a catalyst for development in downtown New Orleans, and that ultimately the state will come out ahead. How do you answer people who say that sometimes you got to spend money to make money?
Here's what I think is going on. Thanks to the media, we found out that from an obscure securities and exchange form that Harris had to file, they're going to sell, as soon as they get the lease renewal, they're going to sell this property to a real estate investment trust. I don't know this for a fact, but the analysts that I have talked to tell me that Harris will probably immediately put $400 million cash in their pocket, between $400 and $500 million cash, and then they will reserve a portion of the future profits, probably, you know, a quarter to a half. I don't begrudge Harris making money. I think Harris is a fine company. But Harris is supposed to do what's best for Harris and their shareholders. Right. We don't have anybody looking out for taxpayers.
Tom on Bluebonnet, Senator, says Harris is offering now a $21 million upfront payment. I think that is accurate, but you're right that originally there was nothing on the table. But there are 17 lobbyists working this for Harris. This means a lot to this company, and 17 lobbyists can make a difference, as we know, when lawmakers are being courted for votes.
Well, they can, and you know, that's Harris' constitutional right to petition its government. But I think it's an indication of what a good deal this is for Harris and how anxious Harris is. And it just seems inconsistent to me. Many policymakers in Baton Rouge, as you know, Jim, are saying that we're broke and we have a fiscal cliff and we need to either raise or renew taxes that are about to expire, and that we have to do it, or we're going to have to unplug the kidney dialysis machines, and people will lose health care, and people, universities will have to shut down, and LSU football will end, and the world will spin off its axis. Well, you know, how can we say, how can you take that position on the one hand, but on the other hand, you have this extraordinary taxpayer asset. This will be one of the biggest business transactions the state of Louisiana has ever entered into. And you take your first offer and don't bid it out, and you don't have any financial advice because Harris wants it and they hire a bunch of lobbyists. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have a dog in this hunt, except for the fact that when the state, I pay taxes in Louisiana, I live in Louisiana, my mortgage is in Louisiana, my spouse and my son are in Louisiana. My son's temporarily away at school. And when Louisiana runs short of dollars, they come to the federal government, Senator Cassidy and I on the Senate side. I'm delighted to help them. You know, the good Lord helps those who help themselves.
Well, you have knowledge of state government going back all those years as treasurer, and before that as counsel to two governors, also Secretary of Revenue. And we've been talking for months about the prospect of you running for governor, and how seriously are you looking at it?
At governor?
Yes.
I'm thinking about it, Jim. I mean, I'm seriously thinking about it. But I haven't reached a decision. I have not polled it. I have been shown two polls by two pollsters. They both show I would win. But that doesn't settle it. I've got to decide it's something that I want to do and something that I can contribute through. I'm happy being a U.S. Senator. This place is, you have good days, bad days, you never have a boring day.
Mm-hmm.
I'll make a decision in the next few months. You know, in the meantime, you know, people want to run, they ought to go run. I believe in competition.
Well,
when I ran for the Senate, I had 14 opponents.
You did. So next few months would mean maybe by July 4th?
I don't know. I hadn't set a timetable. It'll be fairly soon. I'll make a decision. But in the meantime, we ought to go kill this snake of a bill.
Well,
because it's costing the taxpayers money.
It looks like it's facing some distinct opposition in the Senate. And
well, I hope so. And I've talked to a lot of the senators, and they're trying to do the right thing. And I don't take anything away from Speaker Barra. I mean, you know, I think he wants what's best for the state. I know he does. The caller who called in and said, "Well, Harris is offering $21 million." I understand that Harris is offering $21 million up front, but that means they would lower the lease payments. And if Harris wanted to add a zero to that $21 million, make it $210 million cash up front, that wouldn't be enough, but we could start talking. look, if it would cost, I checked, it would cost probably less than $50,000 to go hire a financial analyst to tell us what this license is worth, and then to bid it out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not big consulting contracts, as you know, but it'd be the best $50,000 we ever spent. And if Harris wants to bid, and I'm sure it will, we would welcome their bid. They're a fine company. They should bid.
All right. We've got about 30 seconds, Senator, but should any portion of the sales tax that's expiring be renewed?
Not until they scrub the budget, which it hadn't been done.
Well, Buddy Romer was talking about that 31 years ago. We've been waiting a long time for the budget to be scrubbed, but some people say the Jindal scrubbed it pretty raw. So how much scrubbing is left?
Bobby didn't scrub it. He pulled out his magician tools and just moved numbers around and tried to fool people. And I think I was the first Republican anyway to say that. In fact, the two people who said that first were me and there's this guy named John Bell Edwards, who's the governor.
That's correct.
John Bell was in the legislature then. Bobby didn't scrub it. I like Bobby. He's a fine American, but he didn't scrub the budget.
Thank you, Senator.
But frankly, neither has John Bell.
Well, sounds like the two of you may be talking a bit about this in the months to come. But, Senator, we always enjoy talking with you, and look forward to a conversation again soon. Thank you.
You're a fine American, too, Jim.
I appreciate that. We're back.
You bet.
This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us, 877-217-5757. We're joined now by Andrew Yang. He's been the CEO, co-founder, and executive of a number of technology and education companies. And in early 2018, this year, he announced his candidacy for President of the United States of America. He'll be running in 2020, he says, on a platform of universal basic income of $1,000 per month per American adult. His book is The War on Normal People. Good morning, Andrew Yang.
No, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I remember when I was a little kid, George McGovern talked about a $1,000 giveaway, and that was $1,000, period, end of story, and they called him a nut. You're talking about $1,000 a month for everybody. Is this practical? Is this something that is doable in our country?
Yeah. The economy is going to $19 trillion.
Okay. Let's see, Allie, if we can get to Andrew to a better place. He's fading a bit on us, and he certainly has an interesting story to tell, and is running for the highest office in the land. The book is The War on Normal People. He is the founder of Venture for America. The subtitle, by the way, is The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future. Arianna Huffington says Andrew Yang is a rare visionary who puts dreams into action. He's running for president of the United States and has been named one of the most 100 most creative people in business by Fast Company, graduate of Columbia Law, where he was editor of the Columbia Law Review, and also an undergraduate degree from Brown University, of course, the alma mater of one Bobby Jindal, former governor of Louisiana. And he is an entrepreneur, and he believes that new technologies are erasing millions of jobs and a rallying cry for the urgent steps America must take, including universal basic income, is necessary to stabilize our economy. And I think we have him in a better place. And Andrew Yang, let's start with $1,000 a month per person, and we'll move from there. But is this a practical way to address what you view as the inequity in our country?
Yes, it is. It's the most direct, fair, and equitable way to address it directly, where it counts the most in people's wallets and pocketbooks so they can pay their bills and plan for the future every month. And our economy has grown to $19 trillion per year, up $4 trillion in the last 10 years alone. We are the richest, most advanced society in the history of the world, and we can easily afford a $1,000 freedom dividend to every American adult every month.
Well, right now you are painting a dire portrait of the American economy, and there are those who say the economy is doing pretty well. Your thoughts on why your view is different than many economists who say that when we compare the economy now with, say, a decade ago in the crisis we had in 2008, we've improved immensely. What are your answers to those thoughts about how the economy is doing?
Well, people who paint a rosy portrait of the economy are just paying attention to the wrong things. If you look at GDP growth, yes, we're doing great. But GDP has a lesser and lesser correlation to how Americans are living day to day. The headline unemployment rate is particularly misleading, where you see all these media reports saying 4% unemployment, 4% unemployment, but that does not measure the proportion of people that have now left the workforce. Our labor force participation rate is down to 62.9%, a multi-decade low and comparable to the rates of El Salvador and the Dominican Republic. 95 million Americans are out of the workforce. It also does not measure underemployment and gig employment. Every job that's been created in this country since 2005 is a part-time job that does not have benefits. And the underemployment rate of those even who went to college is 44%, according to the New York Fed. That is, if you graduated from college, there's a 44% chance you're in a job that did not require a degree. So there's rampant weakness in the day-to-day lived experiences of Americans around the country. 59% of Americans right now cannot pay an unexpected $500 bill out of savings. So if you pay attention
to GDP... What was
that?
You're throwing some numbers around, but that one is startling. What percentage of Americans cannot pay a $500 bill?
59%.
Almost 6 out of 10 Americans.
Yes, that's according to multiple surveys that have all come in around the same level.
Well, you predict in your book that 13 million Americans will lose their jobs in the next 7 years and that those jobs won't be replaced. So what happens in the next decade or so? Are we going to have even more of the kinds of concerns that you just allayed, or are we going to have those in play in the next 7 to 10 years?
Yes, we will, and it's timed with a few major advances. So retail is the second largest labor category in the United States, where 1 in 10 American workers works in retail and sales. 30% of malls are going to close in the next 4 years. And anyone listening to this right now can look around and see the storefronts closing right and left, when I see that, it makes me sad. But then I reflect on the fact that I have not gone to that store in months because more and more of our purchases are made online. So that's going to be a massive problem that is just accelerating right now as billions of dollars of commerce flows to Amazon every year. The second big innovation coming down that's going to displace many Americans is self-driving cars and trucks. Truck driving is the most common job in 29 states. 3.5 million truck drivers nationwide, with an additional 5 to 7 million workers supporting them in truck stops, motels, diners, and the like around the country. So those are two very obvious innovations that are coming down the pike really in the next 5 years. I spoke to an executive at one of the major ride-sharing companies, and they project internally that half of their rides will be given by self-driving cars by 2022, which is only 4 years away.
So you're saying we're going to see trucks driving down the road without truck drivers very soon?
Well, we're going to see them. Like, you're not going to see them in your town, probably. But what you are going to see is you're going to see a convoy with one driver and then two robot trucks following on the highway, because that diminishes wind resistance. And it's something of the best of both worlds, where there's like a human in front who can help address any unforeseen issues, but then there are robot-driven trucks right behind them. And then when they get to an urban area, humans will get in the cab for like the last 10 miles. So there probably won't be a self-driving truck driving through your neighborhood, but on the highways there will be.
Well, this all comes down to you believing that we're contracting as far as the opportunities in our country, and that you believe that a panacea is this universal basic income. How would this work, and would it be practical in a capitalistic society?
Well, the great thing about the universal basic income, and I want everyone listening to this to reflect on what the world would look like if you and everyone in your family and neighborhood was getting $1,000 a month, is that it's pro-growth and helps support the consumer economy. The Roosevelt Institute projected that giving everyone $1,000 a month would grow the economy by $2.5 trillion per year, or 13%, and more importantly, would create about 4.5 million new jobs, because if everyone had more purchasing power, more money would be spent in your Main Street businesses, restaurants, tutoring, supplies, etc. And then if you wanted to start a new business, it would make a lot more sense, because all of the people around you have more money to spend. And if your business does not work out, you know you're not going to starve to death or have existential level problems. So a universal basic income is pro-markets, it's pro-growth, it's pro-entrepreneurship, it's pro-work. It's actually the single best thing that our government could do, because our government is not capable of doing a lot of things quickly and well. But it is excellent at sending large numbers of checks to large numbers of people promptly and reliably, because it does that every month right now.
Andrew, which party will you be running as a member of for president in 2020?
I will be running as a Democrat, though I would say that many of my ideas are somewhat independent of party alignment.
When you look at
I'm told that I don't sound like a Democrat, which I take as something of a compliment.
Well, were you supportive of Bernie Sanders when he ran a few years ago?
Yes, I was. I thought Bernie diagnosed our problems very powerfully and was animated by the right spirit to actually improve the lives of the American people.
Well, the book from Andrew Yang, who I'm sure we'll hear from in the next few years more frequently because of his political endeavor, is The War on Normal People, The Truth About America's Disappearing Jobs and Why Universal Basic Income is Our Future. Thank you, Andrew, and best of luck to you, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good
to keep you in touch.
Talk to you later. And tomorrow, our guests include Terry McAuliffe, former governor of Virginia, former Democratic Party chief. He is going to be in Louisiana to speak at the True Blue Gala, and we'll talk with him about American politics as well. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Have a great day and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.